I'm Jay Bernhardt. I'm moderating and speaking here during this panel called Engaging Fans, Followers, and Friends, a lot of Fs, Using Social Media for Improving Health. And so what you're going to hear during the next hour and a half or so is four talks that look at the way new media and social media, new technology, information, consumer-facing technology and informatics really is, will, and continue to revolutionize public health in all respects, in all parts of public health. We are going to, I'm going to briefly introduce myself and go right into my first talk, and then I'll introduce, actually, why don't I introduce the other panelists first, so in between speakers we can go right into that. First, myself, I'm Jay Bernhardt. I'm a professor and chair of health education and behavior at the University of Florida in Gainesville, Florida, Gators. Tim Tebow, because everybody says, are you at USF or where are you in Florida? So I said, no, Tim Tebow. I also direct the Center for Digital Health and Wellness, which is a research and training and practice center focused on the application of new media technology for health promotion and surveillance and disease prevention. Prior to UF, I was at the CDC for 5 years where I directed the National Center for Health Marketing. Prior to that, I was in the faculty at Emory and the Rollins School of Public Health and at the University of Georgia. Happy to be here. After me, our second speaker is going to be Jessica Schindler, who's from the CDC. She's a health communication specialist with the social media team at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. She supports social media and communication efforts, providing leadership and expertise to strategically design, plan, and implement and evaluate the integration of social media within public health campaigns across the agency. So in various parts of the CIOs and branches and programs are planning big campaigns or communication or public education efforts, Jessica is the internal consultant expert who comes in and helps those various programs effectively use social media. And I think she also tweets or used to tweet on behalf of CDC. So when you read the CDC tweets, you're really reading Jessica. Our next speaker after Jessica, we're actually going to have two speakers share the next talk. First, Lauren Soger, is that right, Lauren? Who's the campaign manager for Text for Baby campaign. How many people have heard of Text for Baby in here? Great. From the National Healthy Mothers and Healthy Babies Coalition. She's been on board since Text for Babies launch, serves as member of the management team, providing strategic guidance and leadership on Text for Babies expansion. She manages the marketing and communication and oversees data and evaluation efforts as well, previously led the partner relations activities for Text for Baby, which is significant considering there's over 400 partners involved. 800 now? Wow, 800 partners involved in the coalition. So we should, maybe she could talk to us about that a little as well. She's going to be joined by Susan Kahn, which is a great name, by the way. Susan Kahn. Yeah, it's a stage name. Good. Susan Kahn, of course, who began her career at J&J, Johnson & Johnson in 1999, joined the global marketing group in February 2001 as director of corporate equity. And in this role, she leads the development and implementation of key digital and social media strategies for J&J. Her current focus includes mobile health and digital philanthropy, which, as we know, is growing rapidly and enormously. Prior to joining that group, she spent 12 years at J&J's surgical company, Ethicon Endosurgery, in a number of marketing and leadership roles. And recently, she led the worldwide brand and digital marketing team. Prior to that, she managed several products and procedure marketing areas, including entry into both obesity and plastic surgery businesses. So we're happy to have Susan with us today. Last but not least is David Faust. David is our from APHA leadership and staff. He's the director of communications and has been for a number of years and leads the largest and most diverse association of public health professionals. Oh, that's APHA, I'm sorry. David is in charge of all aspects of CDC's communication, which is a big job, including media relations for AJPH, Nation's Health, all of our annual meeting and mid-year meetings. He's the co-editor of the new, really excellent public health newswire that I hope all of you follow, and maybe he'll talk to us more about that, and really is both a great colleague and friend of communication and public health. So that's our terrific panel today. We're glad you could join us, and I'm going to jump right in. Let me start my timer. Where did I put it? Here it is. Hi, I'm Jay Bernhardt, and I'm here to talk about Public Health 2.0, which is really how, across all aspects of public health practice, we can and we are leveraging new technology. So I'm going to start by giving you some numbers, some background, which lay the foundation not only for my talk, but for the other talks you're going to hear. This is Mark Zuckerberg, and the curve you see on this is not their stock price, much to his chagrin, but it's really the enormous growth of Facebook users. Internet use first. These are Pew. Most of the data I'm going to share are Pew Internet and American Life Project data, but internet use in the U.S. is enormously high, particularly among younger populations, continues to grow among all. These data are through 2010, but the trends continued. Seniors who had been the lowest users and continue to be the lowest users of the internet, that number still continues to grow quite a bit. In essence, many people are using the internet, almost ubiquitous, particularly among younger groups. What people do online really varies significantly, and I think this is important to understand if you're thinking about using the internet for your public health activities. Playing games, for example, is a very common activity, particularly among younger groups, but actually growing significantly among all groups of users of both traditional and mobile media. Watching videos, again, is an incredibly common activity, more common among younger folks, but growing among all groups. Social networking, social media, also quite high. The last bottom circle here is about seeking health information, which is the opposite of those other activities I described, more common among older internet users than younger, not surprisingly. But again, all of these numbers are a bit in flux and changing all the time. The key to remember, though, is that the internet is not a channel. It's not a single type of thing, but it's a diverse media platform that people do all kinds of different activities on. Social media and social network use is enormous growth, and as you all know, has been growing dramatically. These are things like Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Tumblr, and many other channels like that, many other media properties like that, growing dramatically. Although the older populations have lower use currently, they are the fastest growing users of social media. So it is growing quite a bit. So if your grandparents aren't on Facebook yet, they probably will be soon. Really critical to understand from a public health point of view around any kind of internet-based communication is that not all access is created equal, and that that to truly have a fully multimedia internet experience, you need to have home broadband, meaning that you can't, if you're accessing it through dial-up or through other means that are much slower, you don't have nearly as rich a media experience. Anybody in here still have dial-up? Anybody? So clearly, this is the remaining digital divide, if you will. And the government actually is spending a great deal of activity trying to connect rural communities and create incentives for reaching those who don't have home broadband. But there still are percentages who don't, and it's a problem. It's actually, we're really the only developed country for which this is still a problem, because most other countries have, the price points have managed to drop for home broadband activity. Somehow our cable bills stay the same every month. I don't understand it. Called monopoly. When you look, so what's the alternative to home internet, home broadband is mobile and cellular technology, which has grown enormously, really faster diffusion than any other major technology in history. In the U.S. through 2010, there were more than 300 million wireless subscribers, increasing numbers of wireless-only households, meaning they don't have landline telephones. And the device is way more than a phone. In fact, the use of it as a phone is declining somewhat compared to, it's not growing as quickly as it might, but other types of communication on the device are growing incredibly. In 2010 and early 2011, we crossed over in terms of more text messages being sent via mobile devices than minutes of telephone use on the mobile device. And we're talking about in the 2 to 3 trillion range in terms of number of text messages being sent. So pretty enormous. And then again, if you think about what people are doing on their mobile devices, it's not just making calls or just sending text messages, although those are incredibly common, playing games, accessing the internet, taking pictures, all of these types of things are becoming more and more common. And as apps and the devices become even stronger and as smartphone use goes up, what people can do on their devices is just going to grow even more. Text messaging, I've been asked lately actually about, well, what's going to happen when text messaging fades? And that becomes an old thing and something else comes on. I don't think that's going to happen. I think text messaging is absolutely here to stay as a ubiquitous form of communication, and that it's just something everybody will always be using. There are risks about spam and other things like that that might enter into mobile text messaging. But, even if that were to happen, I think it's here to stay, which means I think all of us need to be using it in our activities. Mobile-only households, I mentioned before, these are some recent NCHS data. If you're doing telephone-based data collection for a needs assessment or surveillance or evaluation, it's critical that you have mobile part of your panel, because there are significant differences in the health status and risk behaviors of people who are in mobile-only households versus landline households. So you could see some of these data on here, but very important to keep that in mind. Smartphone use continues to grow significantly. We're right about it now, just about getting to the point where about half of all cell phones being sold in the U.S. are smartphones. And that's going to only go up. And I think that's really important, because when smartphone use is going to just make it so much easier to access the internet on the device, to use the accelerometers and cameras and all these other types of things that are built into this tool, have huge public health potential. So to sort of the two big trends in new media and technology, first is that there's more screens and there's smaller screens. We're exposed to so many screens on a daily basis, we can't even really count them. And just yesterday, I don't know if anyone saw the press about it, but yesterday, Google launched their, publicly shared their Google goggles, these $1,500 gadgets that look amazing. I wish I was wearing a pair right now, because then I could be reading the Twitter stream while I'm talking. But truly, this stuff is revolutionary and amazing. It has amazing potential for us. But what's really important about this is we have to think in small screens. When you're doing messaging, when you're doing your health communication or other activities like that, you got to think about screen size, because if it doesn't look good on a small screen, then you're really wasting a lot of time in your creation. I was at a talk maybe about a year ago, listening to the chief technology officer of Google, and he said that their company predicts that 95% of all search now in the next 4 years will come from a mobile device. So that, you know, that's going to be the primary way people are accessing the internet and information is from mobile devices. And then the other thing that's happened that's revolutionary is this whole 2.0 revolution, where we have increased creation, participation, and collaboration using these technologies. How many of you have seen either of these videos up here? Tell the truth, man. Come on. Evolution of Dance, you haven't seen? Rebecca Black's Friday song? People aren't looking, you're not on YouTube. So these are cultural phenomena, these things. Between these two videos alone, there's probably somewhere upwards of 1.3 billion views of these videos. So you all got to get out a little more on the internet. Get out of your comfort zones. But this whole idea of participation, that these technologies, Facebook and all of these similar types of interactive participatory technologies, allow for multi-directional creation of information, communication, and sharing of information. And that's a dramatic change from any time throughout history, frankly, where there were like media elites and power elites that controlled the information and could share it down with the populace. Now anybody can create and anybody can share, and it really flips the whole model on its head. So the big trends: internet access remains high in developed countries, but there's still some who don't have it, whereas mobile access, nearly ubiquitous everywhere, crosses over all kinds of divides. Media activities are changing with increased collaboration and participation. Gaming, gamification, how many have heard that term? It's a term you'll probably hear more of, the panel all here. The gamification is this idea of information being interactive and participatory and even fun and entertaining. And it makes it more sticky. It makes people more likely to use it and pay attention to it. How many people in here have a game on their mobile device? So imagine that applied to health, right? That's the concept. Digital companies, I took those slides out for speed, but this whole industry, particularly of mobile startups and mobile health startups, is the trend line is like straight up in terms of investment, corporate startup, venture capital flowing into this space. And it's pretty amazing what's going on. So now I'm going to segue to how this applies to public health. When you think about public health in the 21st century, these are the things that we do. These are things that you all and we all do on a regular basis, all grounded in that famous John Snow period of cholera in London through today. This idea we focus on epidemics and outbreaks, but much more than that, of course, and looking at prevention and looking at health promotion and disaster preparedness and all of these other things are all part of what we do. And one way to organize all this is the 10 essential services of public health. How many people in here are familiar with this concept? Okay, good. I'd be afraid if almost every hand went up. So these are the 10 things we do. So what I'm going to do for my remaining 6 minutes, so it's going to be fast, is to show you that in each of these areas, people already are using social media and new media for applying these work, or in the areas where we're not, things that we could be doing. So first and foremost is monitoring. health monitoring, health measurement, surveillance, early detection. And there are incredible, exciting things going on in this space. Some aren't really new, like GFIN. GFIN is really, to some degree, how we discovered SARS in the world, which is a web-based tool run by a Canadian government that looks at how early warnings in newspapers around the world in different languages. But data mashup, social media data mining, looking at the Twitter feed of, you know, thousands or hundreds of thousands of posts on various topics and mining those data for trends, these are all really important and exciting things happening in the space of using these giant, this is what sometimes you hear this called big data. People hear the expression big data. Great New York Times article recently about big data. So big data for public health, both from an informatics point of view, but also from a health promotion point of view, I think is really exciting. That's about the speed I'm going to have time to cover each of these things. So hold your questions and think about what you want to talk more about in the Q&A. Diagnosing and investigating problems at the community level. Again, all kinds of potential exciting things happening in this space, everything from public health grid to using technology, you know, for data intake at clinical settings and integrating all of these data together, as well as just, again, looking at things like Twitter. What are people saying? What is the public saying and reacting to different things? And there's a lot of, we haven't figured it out yet, but there's a lot of very smart people who believe we'll be able to predict population-level trends of public opinion and behavior as a result of mining these very large data sets, which once we can do that, that's pretty amazing. Educating and informing, doing health promotion. This is all, you know, health promotion folks are all over the new media space, looking at user-generated content, like people creating their own PSAs to using mobile gamification, e-cards, text for baby you'll hear more about. There's all kinds of ways that we're using new media for health promotion. Community partnerships and engaging coalitions. Social media are a really powerful tool for engaging coalitions and building social networks. It's already a way that patients, e-patients, engage each other to make decisions and inform their decision making. So I think there's a lot of opportunity in this space. What the early research around this shows is that it's difficult to create a community online. But once a community or coalition is created in person, you can leverage the online tools to keep them more activated over time. That's what the early research on this shows, and I think that makes a lot of sense. From the whole policy and regulatory side of public health, there is a lot of potential for new media, everything from organizing and engaging advocacy activities, as we've heard about at this meeting, to looking at location-based tools like GPS and apps. Smart video capture, is something that has really interesting potential for looking at enforcement of regulations. New York City has cameras that can tell what people are doing. And so, if you want to enforce smoking bans, for example, you theoretically could use things like smart video for those kinds of activities. Linking people to needs and care, where the most important points of need are. Again, we have the ability to track, monitor, and use surveillance at a very micro location level, particularly with mobile devices. And so we can do a much better job of leveraging those data to link and match resources to need. Again, it's just a matter of, in some cases, collecting and using these data effectively. I know I'm going very fast through this. Competent workforce. We've heard a couple of really good panels at this meeting about workforce development and changes in the workforce. Online education, online continuing education, really has a huge potential for helping us improve the workforce and shift the workforce to where we need to go. A little plug here for the Digital Health Communication Extravaganza that my center at UF runs. So if these topics are of interest to you, check out our website, and I'll tell you more about it in Q&A if you want to know, or afterward. 9 and 10, the last two, are really about evaluation and research. And again, like everything else, all of these kinds of technologies and tools have really huge potential in this space. There's a lot of early research underway that's come out. For example, of all the different areas of social media and new media, the area that's probably been the most researched so far is text messaging, SMS, and there's enormous numbers of studies that have been published that show significant positive behavioral change as a result of SMS, text message interventions. And so much of there's actually, I know of 7 review articles that have been published of all the other studies that have already been done. So they're really, it's a growing, strong, evidence-based literature around text messaging. And I hope that there's a need for similar research around all other aspects of this, particularly social media. So in conclusion, there's many potential advantages to this type of work. this increased sustained reach of getting and connecting with large numbers of people at a deeper level of relevance and engagement, scalability and affordability in the sense that when we can develop it for a small number, we can have the same cost for reaching a huge number, and we can build in certain types of measurement and evaluation to our activities. Challenges remain, however. Among them is understanding the audiences and recognizing that different people have different access and different uses and gratifications of media use, and so we need to recognize those differences. There are big barriers, particularly at the local and community level. Some people don't even have access at their desktop. And I hear that over and over from local public health people who their IT people won't let them get on YouTube or Facebook or things like that because maybe they're going to waste time playing games and, instead of doing work. But that's how the world communicates now. And I encourage you to not give up the fight to those IT security people and to help them understand that if the CDC and this state health department and this local health department and all these other places are doing this and it's working, that you can't be so far behind the curve where you are. And then last but not least, we need more research. We have a lot of data on SMS. We need a lot more data on other parts of this type of work. So if you imagine Jon Snow today, if we had the similar cholera outbreak, first of all, he'd probably pick up on it because of barcode scanning, because of the extra run on toilet paper and Kaopectate at the clinics. And then once he knew that, he could pinpoint where are those exact clinics that are having it, look at the Twitter sphere to see who's writing about their GI distress, check the data coming in from the clinics to know where these things are happening, use his text messaging emergency system to say stop drinking the water, looking at Foursquare of where people are getting their water, looking at who's near the pump, and then tweeting with a hashtag about don't drink it, then maybe throw a QR code on the hashtag on the pump to say stop doing it. And with that, I'll say thanks so much.